During this hour of the show, we'll be offering some information on diabetes, a disease which affects some 16 million Americans. And another interesting fact about that is about a third of those people do not know that they have diabetes. There are a number of warning signs and a number of treatment issues that we will talk about during this hour. We have as our guests two people who deal on a daily basis in a clinical setting with diabetes. Becky Roach is a registered dietitian and certified diabetes educator, and she's the nutrition education coordinator at McKinley Health Center on the University of Illinois campus. Also, Sandy Burke is a teaching associate in the College of Nursing here and also a nurse practitioner at McKinley Health Center. She's also a doctoral candidate with a research focus on diabetes in youth and is president-elect for healthcare and education of the American Diabetes Association Heartland Region. They're both here to talk about diabetes and to answer any questions you have. If you would like to call us, the number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL, if that makes it easier to remember. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us around Illinois, Indiana, elsewhere our signal travels, 800-222-9455. Again, around Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL. Elsewhere, 800-222-WILL. Well, to the both of you, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, it's nice to be here this morning.
Well, thanks for being here. Maybe to start with, we could talk about the increase in incidence of diabetes. Apparently, this is something that is not very well understood, but in particular, type 2 diabetes is on the rise.
It is indeed. As a matter of fact, there are two populations that we worry about very much, the elderly and the very young. Some people have suggested that part of the reason for the increase is the increase in obesity and overweight in the country.
Due to sedentary lifestyle and not necessarily due to poorer diets, but I think we're seeing the obesity and the sedentary lifestyle secondary to poorer diets and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Is that clearly understood as a reason for it? My reading about type 2 diabetes, it's not a very well understood disease to begin with.
Indeed. The obesity tends to contribute to the insulin resistance, mm-hmm. which is what then manifests itself in high blood sugars and causes the diagnosis of diabetes.
Sure. Okay. And do you have a sense of how large the increase is, and how recent this has manifested itself?
It seems that over the past 8 or 9 years especially, there has been a significant increase. When we used to talk about this in the early 90s, we were talking about 13 million people with diabetes, mm-hmm. and now just a few years later, it's 16 million. And the good news about that is that more people know that they have diabetes now than they used to. We used to say that half of the people who had diabetes were unaware of it, and now that's down to a third. Mm-hmm. And there is certainly a good news, bad news situation in that more people do know about their diabetes, but still a third of 16 million is a fair piece of folks who still are unaware that they have the disease.
What's very interesting, too, is that type 2 used to be thought of as an older person's disease, mm-hmm. and we're seeing type 2 more and more often now in younger and younger people because of the obesity and the sedentary nature of life. Children even,
right.
Yes. Not just type 1s in children, but type 2.
Well, let's talk about the types of diabetes that maybe people with diabetes have had a reason to learn this stuff, but for a lot of people, perhaps this is kind of new information. There are several different types of diabetes. Maybe you could explain.
Type 1 is more commonly diagnosed in people who are at a fairly youthful time in their life. Actually, it's most commonly diagnosed in early adolescence. And type 1 diabetes is a condition where the body stops making the hormone insulin. Without insulin, you cannot use up sugar from food at all, and you end up with very high blood sugar levels, and that causes, unless it's treated, it causes death very soon. Type 2 diabetes is, as Becky said a moment ago, associated with insulin resistance. So at first, anyway, the body has plenty of insulin, but it doesn't use it properly. And then as time goes on, it's a progressive kind of disease, and there is a little less insulin present in the body as time goes on, although there continues to be a certain amount.
And with type 1 diabetes, really the only way to deal with it is insulin injections.
Absolutely.
Yeah. We have a call to talk with. Let's include them in our conversation and see what's on their mind. And I'm not sure where they're calling from, but they're on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm particularly interested in the connection between depression and diabetes. Would you care to comment on it? Can you tell me where I can get some literature on the topic?
There are a number.
I'm going to hang up and listen. Thank you very much.
Thank you. There are a number of research studies going on right now and with regard to depression and diabetes, and probably one of the best-known researchers is a fellow named Lutzman out of Missouri. I'd recommend that you look at some of his work. It's very well done, but the bottom line is that we don't know which comes first, diabetes or depression, and it's still a mystery.
Interesting. That was a good question. Well, let's talk about some of the warning signs of diabetes. How do people know if they have diabetes?
If they have type 1 diabetes, it seems to come on fairly quickly in that people experience extreme fatigue, extreme thirst, frequent urination. When I talk to my students about this, I say that you're either in the bathroom or at the kitchen sink. It's one way or the other. And the fatigue goes along with that. Sometimes there's blurred vision. Sometimes there is extreme hunger that goes along with it. Sometimes it just feels like you have a bad case of the flu when you go to the emergency room.
Basically, your body's not getting the energy that it needs to function, and so you're exhausted all the time. You're excreting the sugar in the urine and things like that. So it's a very acute onset, and you're usually very aware of the fact that there's something going on and there's a problem. So type 1, we generally know that it's happening.
And as soon as we give insulin, then the symptoms begin to resolve. Type 2 is a little more discreet. You may or may not notice the symptoms until the blood glucose level reaches a level where you have those frequent thirst, frequent urination symptoms. But they are, you know, even though the symptoms are kind of insidious, they come on very slowly, you might sit back and be able to say, yes, I do feel more tired now than I used to. Or, you know, I wonder why my vision is blurring. That blurred vision at first is a reversible kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I wonder why that's happening. Or I wonder why I have an infection that won't go away. And you seek help for those kinds of things. We encourage people to take the diabetes risk test. Mm-hmm. This is actually Diabetes Alert Week, and so we have lots of risk tests available for people.
And I think often when you know you're at risk, then you can be a little bit more aware of the physical symptoms that may come up that may just kind of seem subtle and not be something you can identify. But if you've taken the risk test and you know that there are that you're at high risk for diabetes, then you can be a little bit more aware of those risk signs.
Okay, well, what are some of the risk factors in that?
Being weighing too much for your body height, so having a
high BMI, body mass index. Exactly.
Having a family history of type 2 diabetes. If you're a woman, having had a baby greater than 9 pounds,
And that's a surprise to a lot of people. I was just talking to a colleague this morning who didn't realize that having a child or having a baby who is heavy is actually a risk factor for diabetes. Often it indicates that there was gestational diabetes going on during the pregnancy. Mm-hmm. And if you have had gestational diabetes, you're at higher risk for diabetes type 2 later in life. So,
and then being over 40 years old.
Yeah, those age is still a risk factor.
Age is still a risk factor.
Risk factor for a lot of things.
It is. But we all still want to keep getting older. So,
having a sedentary lifestyle. Mm-hmm. So lack of exercise, too much body weight, family history, increasing age, all of those things.
What weight does family history play into this? Is there a very strong genetic link?
With type 2, absolutely.
Yeah.
There is indeed a genetic relationship with type 1 as well, but it is a very strong linkage with type 2 diabetes, so absolutely. There's a myth out there that diabetes skips a generation, and that is indeed a myth. It doesn't necessarily skip. So you do need to be alert. You need to pay attention.
Is it a myth, Sandy, or is it true that if you have diabetes on your father's side of the family, there is a stronger risk for you than if it's on the mother's side?
They say that that's true for type 1 diabetes.
For type 1, okay.
What are some of the – you mentioned some of the symptoms, extreme thirst, fatigue, weight loss, blurry vision, frequent urination, and so forth. Those are symptoms, obviously. What are some of the damaging physical characteristics that diabetes can cause?
That's a good question. If diabetes is untreated for a long period of time, as it is in the vast numbers of people who are undiagnosed, people can actually develop chronic complications. We now say that we have always known that people have heart disease and stroke and higher risks of those than people in the general public, but now we're actually identifying diabetes-related strokes, diabetes-related heart attacks. Those are the two probably most common things that people are concerned about. But in addition to heart attack and stroke, diabetes is also the leading cause of kidney failure in this country, and it's also the leading cause of blindness in this country. And it is associated with a condition called neuropathy or nerve fiber damage that can lead to loss of limb.
Amputation.
A toe, a half of a foot, half of a leg.
The nerve simply atrophy.
After the amputation, you mean?
No, prior.
Not necessarily atrophy, but peripheral vascular disease goes along with that, and so you have discoloration in the limb, you have lack of sensation in the limb. And
prior to that, there's the tingling and the pain, actually, the symptoms of mm-hmm. the neuropathy.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So it's not a surprise, you know, to people who have neuropathy, they know that something bad is going on.
And I think a lot of the amputations happen because there is an infection that takes place in one of the extremities that's not treated, mm-hmm. or it may be even treated, but people with diabetes have such a hard time healing from trauma and things like that.
Exactly.
That it's just wounds can't heal.
Let me just reintroduce our guests this morning. We're talking with Becky Roach and Sandy Burke. They're both with the McKinley Health Center at the University of Illinois. And Becky is a registered dietitian and is the nutrition education coordinator at McKinley. Sandy Burke is a nurse practitioner, and her research in her doctoral work focuses on diabetes in youth. And we're taking your questions on diabetes. If you'd like to pose those, you can call us around Champaign-Urbana at 333-9455. Toll free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. I wanted to sort of ask you to talk about the interdisciplinary nature of the work that goes on in dealing with diabetes. There is a diabetes team that you're part of at McKinley, yes?
We're very fortunate to be working in a collegial kind of relationship. So, yes, diabetes really is best managed when the patient is at the center of the team, when there's a physician who's familiar with diabetes management, somebody like me, a nurse practitioner, somebody like Becky, who's a registered dietitian, who is a certified diabetes educator. We also like to take advantage of people who have expertise in stress management. The caller earlier referred to depression, mm-hmm. so people who can do counseling are important as well. Exercise physiologists. We really, you know, we've got all of those resources here, and feel very
good
fortunate.
Diabetes care really does involve a team approach. Mm-hmm. All of those people need to be involved.
We have another caller to talk with. Let's include them in our conversation. This is a listener in Urbana on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi, good morning. I just joined the conversation, so I hope you haven't covered this, but I had a baby last June and developed gestational diabetes. I'll be 37 years old next month. What is the percentage, or the likelihood, I should say, that I will develop diabetes, and when would that be most likely to happen?
Well, I think we can give you a relative percentage, but as far as when it would be most likely to happen, that's not as clearly understood. They say that after having had gestational diabetes, your risk for developing type 2 diabetes later in life is anywhere from 40 to 70%.
Okay.
And that really depends in terms of when you develop it and whether or not you mm-hmm. develop it. Mm-hmm. Depends on whether or not you get back to your ideal or
healthy body weight. Right.
Body mm-hmm. weight. And exercise routinely. There's some great research going on right now with prevention of type 2 diabetes.
I think it's so exciting. We really are showing that it may be possible to at least delay the onset of diabetes, if not prevent diabetes altogether, by being involved in a regular exercise program. That, of course, contributes to getting that weight back down to a healthy body mass index. But the exercise itself helps your body to use the insulin that it has more effectively. So exercise is going to be a very important part of your own self-care and getting to a healthy body weight after the delivery of your baby.
Is there any sort of exercise that it would recommend or the length of the exercise? I was able to control with my gestational diabetes using exercise and diet during my pregnancy.
Excellent.
But do they recommend anything to any type of exercise, again, or the length?
We just, as a matter of fact, talked to a friend of ours who's an exercise physiologist about a week ago, as a matter of fact, Peggy Weineke here on campus, and she recommends to her patients with type 2 that walking is a very effective means of keeping blood sugars under control, and she says start out with 20 to 30 minutes, and if you can, expand that to 45 minutes, up to an hour, and she recommends a minimum of 5 days a week.
And good brisk walking.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Purposeful walking.
Oh, great. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks very much for the call. Good luck. So aerobic activity.
Aerobic is best. Mm-hmm. It really is a good way to get the insulin moving and make the body more sensitive to its insulin. Becky, can you address some of the changes in nutrition over the last couple of years?
There have been huge changes in nutrition therapy for diabetes just recently, and there continue to be. It's a real exciting field to be involved in. And in the old days, we used to deal pretty much with the idea that people with diabetes shouldn't be able to eat any kind of sweet or sugary foods. And the way we taught them how to eat was by giving them an exchange list and dividing their calories out through the day and giving them a pretty rigid structure to follow while they have diabetes. And that led to not good control, because most people who are presented with a specific diet to follow exactly like this all the time don't do that very well. Mm-hmm. So what we've done over the last 4 or 5 years, really since I've been involved in medical nutrition therapy and diabetes, is to focus the nutrition therapy as a more individualized kind of prescription, look at how the patient is eating now, try and work in as many of their likes and dislikes. We've come to recognize that total carbohydrate intake, not necessarily the type of carbohydrate, is probably more important than saying sugar is bad for you and you shouldn't eat sugar, that sort of thing. There are just a lot fewer no-nos in eating for diabetes these days than there used to be. And I think that's a real freeing kind of thing for a patient. It puts the patient more in control, lets them control their disease more than letting their disease control them. And we find that there's better patient receptivity to nutrition therapy in diabetes, which, of course, gives better blood sugar control.
Is the object of managing one's diet essentially managing insulin levels? I mean, what is the purpose of a diet?
There's a little bit of a dichotomy there, depending on whether you're looking at type 1 diabetes or type 2 diabetes. But in general, you're looking at a healthy diet to avoid the cardiovascular complications of diabetes, so a healthy low-fat diet, no matter whether you have type 1 or type 2. In type 2 diabetes, often you're looking to try and lose some weight to get it to a healthy body mass index. In type 1 diabetes, you may be looking at trying to gain some weight, especially in adolescence. But healthy weight control is a facet of both kinds of diabetes and nutrition therapy. Just looking at healthy diet in general, I often find myself saying to patients, you know, if 100% of the American public would follow the same kinds of guidelines that I'm talking to you about eating healthfully, we'd all be much healthier. People with diabetes just have a more compelling reason to look at a healthy diet often than the rest of the American public.
Absolutely. Weight loss is not cosmetic for those folks.
Exactly.
Good way to put it. We have another caller to talk with. Let's include them. This is another listener in Urbana on line number 1. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi, ladies. Thanks for being here. My question is, why is there such a wide range on the quality of care that a diabetic receives in this city? And I think it goes from poor to just average. And what can a diabetic patient do about that quality of care or that lack of quality?
Well, it sure is a tough question. I can tell you that the vast majority of people with diabetes receive their care, their primary diabetes care, from a primary health provider. And that's not just in Champaign-Urbana. That's countrywide and perhaps even worldwide. Part of the reason, I think, that there is such a big difference in how providers treat diabetes is because until fairly recently, There weren't very good data to support the notion that diabetes causes complications. That really has happened just in the last, 6 or 7 mm-hmm. years with, in 1993, the Diabetes Control and Complications Trial results saying very clearly that type 1 diabetes, when it's well controlled, can result in fewer complications. And then just in 1997, the results of the UK PDS, that's the United Kingdom Prospective Diabetes Study, mm-hmm. those results came out in 97, saying basically the same thing for people with type 2 diabetes. Well-controlled diabetes can result in fewer complications. And, you know, healthcare providers are very cautious. You know, they don't jump on the bandwagon until they have a lot of good data out there. And now we finally do. We've got good data out there, and we're trying to promote that message across the board. One of the goals of the American Diabetes Association that's an ongoing goal is providing that kind of good information on good diabetes care to primary care providers. Mm-hmm. Instead of just keeping that within the diabetes community, actually sending that information out. As far as what the patient with diabetes can do, I recommend to all of my patients with diabetes that they learn as much about their disease as they possibly can.
Mm-hmm. So they become an active participant in their own
absolutely.
Care.
Absolutely.
Right. I've tried that, and then you get treated like, well, you're trying to be the doctor. You know, I'm the doctor. You're the patient. You know, you're not going with the flow, which makes it easier in our healthcare system, you know, to be in and out of your visit mm-hmm. within 10 minutes or whatever. And I understand it is the healthcare system, you know, that's a lot to blame, but it just gets very frustrating and depressing, you know, for someone who is trying to be an active participant. Hang up and just listen.
It is difficult, I think. I'm very much a proactive patient advocate, and I really believe that patients have to feel comfortable with their practitioner, with their doctor, and maybe even do some interviewing. You know, assert the fact that I have diabetes and I want to take good care of it, and I want to do some pretty intensive management of my diabetes because I understand that that can avoid the complications.
Mm-hmm.
And so talking to the doctors about that before you actually establish
Excellent.
Care.
Absolutely.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's probably good advice for any health situation.
I think
it
so.
Is.
Yeah.
Well, the caller raises a question. How well are physicians in general educated about especially some of the more recent research on diabetes?
I can't answer that with any degree of certainty at all. What I can say is that I've noticed there seems to be a great deal more in the medical literature in the last mm-hmm. couple of years than I noticed in the early part of the 90s or even in the 80s. Most of the research that I saw in the previous to 1995 was in the diabetes-specific literature, mm-hmm. and I don't think most primary care
providers. So if you weren't paying attention to that, you didn't catch that.
Right.
So, and I think your point earlier was very good, Sandy. The fact that there is more information out there, and we do know that you can avoid the complications, which are very expensive, has compelled more and more of the family practice kind of practitioners to really pay attention to diabetes and to recognize that good care of diabetes can have an impact on all of the health issues for their patients.
Well, I really believe that. I also believe that you can find an advocate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether
I believe
it's
so too.
A dietitian, a diabetes nurse. There are there's an entire association, the American Association of Diabetes Educators, and I believe their website is aadenet.org, and they have a nationwide list of diabetes educators.
Very good. We're about at our midpoint talking this morning during this hour, Focus 580, about diabetes. Our guests are Becky Roach and Sandy Burke. They're both on the McKinley Diabetes Team at the McKinley Health Center. Becky Roach is a registered dietitian, and Sandy Burke is a nurse practitioner. And they both work with patients, diabetic patients on a daily basis, and we're talking about that. If you have questions, I think we have one caller waiting and would welcome others. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener in Oak Lawn on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Good morning.
Thank
you for your wonderful program.
Thanks.
There is a blood test called glycohemoglobin blood test.
Easy for you to say.
sorry, I stumbled over. As I understand it, it tells the blood sugar for about a period of 3 months. Are you familiar with that test, and is there some reliability to it?
Oh, it's a very reliable
and
test.
And we try not to stumble by calling it the A1C.
It's called the A1C.
Yes.
Okay.
It is. It's been available since for widespread use since about the mid-'80s, and it is an excellent adjunct to care. We generally recommend that patients with type 1 diabetes have that test done quarterly, so about every 3 months, and people with type 2 anywhere from twice to four times a year, depending upon the level of diabetes control that you have been able to achieve. It is an extremely valuable test. It does give us a backward look at how well the diabetes has been controlled over a previous 6 to 10 week period of time.
Okay. Also understanding that it's not a replacement for daily monitoring of your own blood sugars. It's something that you want to look at.
It's an adjunct,
mm-hmm,
too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Exactly.
Now, if a person, I just had a physical. Mm-hmm. Can I lay this on the line? My blood sugar came out 113.
Okay.
Now, where do you consider that in a range? Of a range, 80 to 110 is the range that my blood test form shows, it being within the normal range. I'm 3 points higher. I have diabetes on my mother's side.
Okay.
I've been in the hundreds, not beyond 113. Am I close?
Yes.
In your opinion?
Yes,
you're close. You are lower than the diagnostic level of type 2, of any kind of diabetes, as a matter of fact. The current diagnostic level of diabetes is 126.
Okay.
So that if somebody is greater than 110, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, but less than 126, mm-hmm, they might fall into a very gray area that some people call impaired fasting glucose or
impaired glucose tolerance,
mm-hmm, depending upon when you had the test done, right. So you just need to keep watching, and again, as we said earlier, practice healthy habits.
Yeah, it's kind of that tap on the shoulder that says, need to pay attention to this. This is important. You know, you don't have diabetes, but you're at high risk for diabetes. You've got a family history. You've got an impaired fasting glucose. So you really want to take care to keep your body mass index in a healthy range, and you want to take care to do some daily exercise.
Indeed, I will, and thank you so much for your program.
Thanks for calling.
Bye. Thanks for the call. We'll move on to a listener in Champaign on line number one next. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. When Susan Kunzat was on, a week or two ago, she mentioned that some new research on glucosamine sulfate, which a lot of people take for joint pain, seems to indicate a link between that and diabetes. Have you heard or read anything about that?
I'm afraid I don't know anything about glucosamine sulfate and diabetes, and I haven't read anything about it. I know it's a supplement that a lot of people are taking. My issue with that would be if you have diabetes and you are taking glucosamine sulfate, that you want to monitor your blood sugar after you take it and see if it does cause any rise in your blood sugar, see if you can see the effects on your own test to show that there's a raise.
Okay. Well, I know my mother, who's nearly 80, started taking glucosamine sulfate, and she thinks it has made a difference in her arthritis. But she also, at her last physical, for the first time in her life, was, you know, the doctor said, you better look at this. You're getting close to the diabetic range. So after hearing that, I just wondered if there was a link. Do you know where I could find more information out about that?
I'm trying to think of a website that would help you out, and it seems to me that I've seen a website on herbal supplements, but I can't recall the address.
And there are a number of them. The one that I tend to use for herbals most often is the NIH site. Just type in a search in a Google or in some search engine, the National Institutes of Health Alternative Medicine Herbs, and you should get their address.
Okay, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for the call. Indeed, there are a lot of web resources. I was doing a little bit of surfing yesterday and came across a site in Australia and, of course, the American Diabetes Association. And I think you mentioned one before we started, which is simply www.diabetes.org.
Yes, that's the American Diabetes Association.
Right.
And that's certainly one of the most comprehensive sites out there. But there are a couple of really good sites. People need to be a little cautious, though, because some of the sites that are out there don't have accurate information.
When you put diabetes in as a search, you come up with people's own personal websites, and you come up with just so many different kinds of things. So it's important to look at the credibility of the resource.
As always on the web, there's a lot of noise out there, along with the good signal.
We have our diabetes team has a website. webpage, and we can hyperlink to a number of other relevant websites, including the National Institutes of Health and CDC, the dietitian's website, which is
American Dietetic Association.
Right, and that is www.eatright.org.
What was that again? I'm sorry.
www.eatright.org.
I love that.
Mm-hmm, I do too.
And a couple of the other sites I think that we've got on there include the International Diabetes Center out of Minnesota and the Joslin Diabetes Center out of New England.
Mm-hmm. And the McKinley website is www.mckinley.uiuc.edu. And the diabetes team page is just an easy click from there.
Well, very good. We have a couple other callers waiting. We'll get right onto them. This is a listener in Downs next on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
This is another mother question. My mother's in her late 70s and has had diabetes since she was 50, which acted like a type 1 diabetes, and she's always taken insulin, started out doing it several times a day, and checking her blood sugar. And she's been very healthy. In fact, she had 2 foot surgeries and healed extremely well. One of her problems is that she is very thin, and her doctor wants her to gain weight. And she finds it very hard to gain weight and stay with, you know, with dietary good sense, you know, which she really does have and always has had.
And congratulations to your mother for taking good care of her diabetes and taking good care of her blood sugars.
Yeah, she's been wonderful.
That's great.
Absolutely.
That's great. I think it is a challenge when people with diabetes are trying to gain weight because often if they're eating more carbohydrate, that may indicate a need to increase their insulin dosage.
Right.
And what we need to recognize is that that's okay. The bottom line is keeping those blood sugars under control. And if your mother is going to concertedly try to gain weight and finds that she is taking in more carbohydrate, she may want to go back to her practitioner and say, I need to have a little bit more insulin to cover my increased intake of carbohydrate.
She's always, I mean, for some time now, her doctors have recognized that she does this well, and, you know, she's pretty much on her own in terms of what she takes.
Mm-hmm. So she decides?
Yeah,
very
much. And that's a good idea. And she's her doctors have told her that she maybe is too
rigid.
And too concerned about these things.
I don't think it's possible to be too concerned about diabetes.
No, but I mean with what she eats and the, a little too strict about it. The other thing is that she does have a heart condition, and so she also doesn't want to eat fat. Mm-hmm.
Well, some of the fairly healthful fatty kinds of foods, the monounsaturated fats, which are high in calories and can help her with some weight gain and may not affect her blood sugars too much, are going to be things like olives and avocados and nuts. Foods that have a lot of protein and a lot of fat don't tend to have nearly as much effect on blood sugars as the carbohydrate-containing foods.
Okay.
So increasing her intake of those healthy kinds of fats in her olive oil and canola oil and her olives and her nuts and her avocados and even her lean meats and low-fat cheeses and low-fat dairy may be helpful in trying to get a few more pounds on her.
Could she use some of those as snacks between meals?
She could, And with just, you know, especially the really high-fat foods, there's not going to be much of an effect on the blood sugar.
Okay. The other question, if we can do this quickly, she's been in the hospital several times. And every time she goes to the hospital, she has insulin shock. And it seems to me when I'm there, it just drives me crazy because they don't seem, I mean, they come in and say, oh, Mrs. Hebert, Mrs. Levy, it's time for your injection. They give her a set amount, which she has never done. She always tests herself and, you know, and then they won't feed her for 3 hours or, you know, and it's just a nightmare.
I think it's a really hard management issue in institutional care.
Lots of people have problems with hypoglycemia in the hospital because a hospital diet is
and she just hates the food.
Well, there's that too. But it's usually a prescribed caloric diet. You know, the doctor will write a 1,500 calorie, we used to call them ADA diets, and that's pretty much all that will be available on the trays. And most people don't eat that at home, and so the dose of insulin that you take at home doesn't fit with the hospital regimen. It's a hard problem to solve.
And I think that having food, you know, having some carbohydrate sources there in the hospital, some fruits, some
bottle of glucose tablets at the table.
Yes, exactly, and the glucose tablets, having those available because she knows that this is a potential situation and kind of trying to cover that beforehand.
But I think that what frustrates me is that she controls it so well.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And then suddenly she's in a place where someone else is controlling it,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and everything seems to fall apart.
Yeah. And we do know that the intensive management and the frequent insulin injections and things like that do give us better control of our blood sugars, but they do cause hypoglycemia more often, and that's a real scary situation.
She doesn't have that problem when she's tired.
On her own.
When she's on her
mm-hmm.
own.
Mm-hmm.
Well, other than trying to have something there to kind of counteract it.
That's the only way that I would know, because you're not going to get the hospital to deliver her meals separately from everyone else's, or very few hospitals will do that.
Mm. But what you might be able to do is have her talk a little bit to her doctor ahead of time and say, look, I don't want this to happen, so can we reduce the amount of insulin that you have ordered and play it like that?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks and good luck. We have just about 10 or 12 minutes left talking about diabetes with Becky Roach and Sandy Burke from the McKinley Health Center Diabetes Team. We have one caller waiting, and we have time for others if you'd like to join us. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Elsewhere, 800-222-9455. We'll talk next with another Urbana listener on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi, I was listening to your when you were talking about the causes for diabetes, and it brought to mind my experience. I used to work in northern Quebec with the Indians,
mm-hmm.
and there are the door of our fridge was full of different kinds of insulin.
Mm.
And then I went to northern Canada in the Northwest Territories and worked with the Eskimo people or the Inuit.
Yes.
We had two vials of insulin in the fridge just in case somebody became diabetic.
Mm-hmm.
And it brought to mind what the difference is there. I know with the Eskimo people that I was working with, their first contact with white people was in the 1950s when the federal government flew them from inland to the coast of Hudson's Bay because they were starving to death. And I don't know, but I wonder if it's because they have had such little contact with sugar. Now everybody is eating white man's diet up there, and it's all prepackaged and that kind of thing. They do still eat caribou meat and fish and some seal and stuff, but what do you think about that? Is that the difference between the Indian and the Eskimo, where they've had so much more contact with processed and sugared foods?
That's really not what it looks like at this point. It's not just sugar in the diet, but it's the diet in
mm-hmm.
general.
Exactly.
And the amount of exercise. And that's mm-hmm. something that really has made us all sit up and take notice mm-hmm. in that, there are certain populations, and this is an excellent question to let me have an opportunity to talk about the people who are really at highest risk.
Mm-hmm.
People of color in general, African Americans, Hispanic Americans, Native Americans, and right now Pacific Islanders mm-hmm. as well, have an incredibly high risk for type 2 diabetes. Some of that research that's been done really shows the difference between Native Americans who live in their native habitat and those who live on reservations where they have very little exercise, a completely different lifestyle, and the amount of diabetes in those kinds of populations, and Native Americans in particular, can be as high as 70%.
Mm-hmm.
It's really amazing.
The thing that surprised me about my experience was with the Inuit. They were overweight. Many of them were just enormous, but they still didn't have the diabetes, although the one thing that does come to mind was that they did get a lot of exercise because they were always out hunting or berry picking. Would that be enough to keep it under control for them?
I believe that it would. I believe that there's also an issue of the genetic predisposition, and it may be in the Inuit there's not as much of a genetic predisposition as there is in the Eskimo population. But I really believe that the activity and the exercise is just a huge factor. And if they're still continuing to be active, I think that may decrease their incidence.
Do you know, the other thing is that there's something about the distribution of body fat.
Mm.
If it's total body distribution, then the likelihood of diabetes is less than if the distribution of body fat is localized to the trunk.
Mm-hmm. At midsection.
The midsection.
The first woman who got diabetes after I left the village was a lady who was part white. One of her grandparents, I think, had been white.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, that was another interesting factor for me mm-hmm. as I've been just mulling it over in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you.
Well, thanks. Thanks, very interesting. Well, we'll go on next to another caller. This is someone in Madison, Wisconsin, on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes. I'd like to ask, is honey a good food to use generally, and especially for elderly people or people who might be prone to diabetes?
Honey is a sweetener, just as sugar is a sweetener, just as anything else that's sweet is a sweetener. It has carbohydrate. It will have an effect on blood sugar. If you like the taste of honey, it's a fine thing to use, but it will raise blood sugar just as sugar will raise blood sugar.
Okay. And what are some, more details about the symptoms for diabetes, like the thirst and also the fatigue or weakness? Does the fatigue, is it throughout the day, or does it develop slowly toward the evening or the morning, or what?
Well, it seems to be progressive as the level of glucose in the body rises. So when the blood sugar level is closer to normal, you don't notice the fatigue so much. But as the sugar gets above 200, then above 300, then above 400, it is a persistent kind of fatigue. It doesn't necessarily get any better or any worse as the day goes on. It's just very difficult to find any energy.
Okay. Also, I'd like to ask with I know some people, and I know if there's some studies regarding the use of alpha lipoic acid, also known as thioctic acid. There's some of the better clinics in Europe which supposedly have been using it now, and it's available safe as an over-the-counter supplement in the United States. And also things such as cinnamon has been shown to be helpful amongst users to lower diabetes. And also fish oil in the form of DHA, not to be confused with DHEA. That's DHA for diabetic neuropathy. And the DHA can also be obtained from cod liver oil, and I know there's manufacturers in the United States that get it from algae, which is where the fish get it from in the first place. And do you have any comments on using alpha lipoic acid to lower blood sugar, or cinnamon to lower it, or the fish oil to improve the diabetic neuropathy?
I'm not familiar with the alpha lipoic acid and its effects. I have heard some people talk about the cinnamon. I don't know of any studies that have been done to show that it's efficacious, really, or whether it's just someone's personal experience in having used it. The fish oil is something that, when I divide it away and look at the healthfulness of those omega-3 fatty acids from the fish oil, I think, you know, eating fatty fish on a regular basis, 2 or 3 times a week, can be helpful. And for people with diabetes, may even be helpful in lowering triglyceride levels in the blood. So using the, you know, fish oil from fatty fish, I think, is a good thing to do. I'm not sure whether supplementing is something you want to look at with your health care provider to make sure that you're not using other kinds of medications that might interfere in some way.
Okay. And with the another thing that's been helpful amongst many people with diabetes has been who know about it, that is, has been using sufficient water because of some physiological effects that when the body takes in something sweet, water that's in the system goes inside the cells and therefore can create somewhat of a dehydration. And there's two interesting websites that I'd strongly recommend anyone with diabetes to look at for themselves and evaluate it. It's watercure.com and watercure2 with the digit 2.com. And these people there have helped a number of people with diabetes on the basis of taking additional water. And it's a non-toxic, cheap treatment that can be beneficial.
Hmm.
And also, I know the previous caller was interesting. She mentioned the Indians of northern Quebec had the diabetes, whereas the Inuit did not. And I'm just wondering if that's because those Indians had longer contact with the white man or whether their diet was different. It's interesting what she had to say.
Yeah. Interesting observations, yeah. And with regard to the water issue, you've lighted on one of my favorite things, that we all need to drink more water. I'm not familiar with any studies that show the physiologic effect of more water on blood sugars, but I think that we all need to get in our 8 to 10 8-ounce glasses of water on a daily basis.
It's good for a lot of things.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Well, so apologize to the caller from Madison for moving on, and glad to hear from you from Wisconsin. But we're running into our last couple of minutes, and I have another listener in Peoria I want to include in our conversation on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, such a delightful program, and I got in late. My wife has been type 1 since, well, for 49 years. And, of course, through that course of time, there are a lot of different things that have occurred. One of the really helpful things, of course, is the monitoring many times a day and watching the hemoglobin A1C. The other day we ran across an interesting thing. I'd like your comment on it. They mentioned that people who have a blood loss or who build new blood rather rapidly, since the A1C reading is watching the, and I can't pronounce the name, but the coating around the red blood cells, that if those are being replaced, sometimes you get an abnormally low reading. I'm just wondering if you've run across some additional information, because that's a concern. She has beautiful, you know, point, you know, fives quite often, but I wonder, is this perhaps because she's building new blood cells and replacing the old, where they don't get a chance to become as coated or be as many coated ones as there would normally be?
Well, what I'm thinking is that if people have like blood transfusions,
exactly,
then that would certainly have an impact on their hemoglobin A1C. But if and everyone makes new blood cells every single day, so that as time goes on, that's why the hemoglobin A1C only goes back about 10 to 12 weeks, is because we continue to make new blood cells every day and continue to recycle the old ones on a daily basis as well. So you're looking at an average of the amount of blood cells that are in there at any given time. But as far as making blood cells more frequently or more often, there are some medical conditions that can be associated with that. But usually if you have one of those, you're well aware of that. So I don't know that that would be an issue with your wife in particular. What I usually tell patients to do is compare their home blood glucose monitoring records with the hemoglobin A1C, and there should be a correlation there. There should be a very clear relationship, so that if your home records are showing an average of a blood sugar of about 150, then your hemoglobin A1C should come out in the range of 7 or 8%. The lower the hemoglobin A1C, the lower the average blood glucose is.
So, yeah, it sounds to me like your wife just has very good control over her blood sugars.
She runs really low. In fact, it's amazing, and we know that you do become tolerant for low sugars over a period of time. And, you know, she runs 70 with regularity, and on occasions when she's in the hospital, if she hits 50, they become alarmed. She's still lucid at that point. So, you know, her body's accustomed to that and doesn't get the little shakes and so on until we get really serious. But I that bring one other little quick thought.
We're going to have to wrap it up pretty quick. Sorry.
But I've appreciated it so much. Thank you again.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much. And I'm sorry that we're out of time, but that just simply happens too quickly every hour on Focus 580. I'll mention again that for people who want to learn more, they can look at the website at McKinley, which is www.mckinley.uiuc.edu, and there are links to other
the diabetes page is one of the links on that homepage for McKinley.
Well, very good. Mm-hmm. Our guests have been Becky Roach and Sandy Burke from McKinley Health Center. Thanks very much, both of you.
Thanks,
Thank
Jack.
You.